From COP23, the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany, this is Democracy Now!
Gas 25. The chart.
American, but we see right through your greed. It's killing all across the world for that coal money. And we proudly stand up until you keep it in the ground.
Revolt. As the Trump administration makes its debut at COP23 by trying to push coal, gas, and nuclear power. Democracy Now! Is there.
I'm Amy Goodman from the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
This is our last question before we have to wrap up.
Quick question, just a simple yes or no from each of you, whether you support President Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord.
Stay tuned for their answers. Then Kumi Naidu, former head of Greenpeace, on his new initiative, Africans Rising. And today is Gender Day here at the UN Climate Summit. We speak with the first female president of the Marshall Islands, Hilda Heine.
Today, as the first woman leader of an independent Pacific Island nation. Thank you. In the Pacific, it is often women and mothers who are at the heart of our communities and ensure resilience. If women do not plan for the long term, families and communities do not
thrive. Today, Marshall Islands President Hilda Heine, along with her poet daughter, climate activist Kathy Jetnell Kitchener. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Bonn, Germany. The death toll from Sunday's earthquake on the Iran-Iraq border has topped 540. More than 8,000 people were injured in the magnitude 7.3 earthquake. Most of the deaths occurred in Iran, where more than 12,000 homes were destroyed, leaving many people homeless as winter approaches. Puerto Rico's governor has asked the federal government for $94 billion to help repair critical infrastructure and rebuild housing following Hurricane Maria. More than half the island remains without power 7 weeks after the hurricane hit. More than 10% of the island is without running water. In news from Alabama, a fifth woman has come forward to accuse Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore of sexual misconduct. Beverly Young Nelson says Moore sexually assaulted her in 1977 when she was 16 years old. At the time, he was in his 30s. Nelson said the incident occurred after Moore offered to drive her home from her waitressing job.
I was terrified. He was also trying to pull my shirt off. I thought that he was going to rape me. I was twisting, and I was struggling, and I was begging him to stop. I had tears running down my face. At some point, he gave up. And he then looked at me and he told me, he said, "You're just a child." And he said, "I am the district attorney of Etowah County. And if you tell anyone about this, no one will ever believe you."
Meanwhile, The New Yorker magazine reports a few years later, Roy Moore was banned from a local mall and a YMCA in Alabama because he repeatedly badgered teenage girls, in some cases soliciting sex from them. Moore, a former state judge and DA, has denied the accusations. A growing number of Republican Party leaders, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, are urging Moore to drop out ahead of the December 12th special election to fill Jeff Sessions' former Senate seat. Meanwhile, a sixth woman has come forward to accuse former President George H.W. Bush of groping her. Rosalind Corrigan says she was 16 years old when Bush grabbed her buttocks as she was stood next to him for a photograph during a public event at a CIA office in Texas. President Trump has nominated Alex Azar, a former top executive of pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly, to lead the Department of Health and Human Services. The post has been vacant since the resignation of Tom Price. Public Citizen's Rob Weissman criticized the nomination, saying, quote, Tom Price supported Big Pharma in the U.S. Congress. Now, apparently, Trump has decided to cut out the middleman and let a pharmaceutical executive literally run the federal department that protects the health of all Americans, unquote. President Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., has admitted he had some direct contact with WikiLeaks during the 2016 campaign. Trump Jr. made the admission after The Atlantic magazine revealed WikiLeaks repeatedly sent him private direct messages on Twitter during the campaign. Occasionally, Trump Jr. responded. On October 12, 2016, WikiLeaks urged Trump Jr. to have his father linked to the site containing the hacked emails of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta. 15 minutes later, candidate Donald Trump himself tweeted, very little pickup by the dishonest media of incredible information provided by WikiLeaks, so dishonest, rigged system, unquote. Also on Election Day, WikiLeaks urged Trump Jr. to tell his father not to concede if he lost. This comes as Attorney General Jeff Sessions is heading to Capitol Hill today to testify before a congressional hearing on alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Some Democratic lawmakers have accused Sessions of committing perjury for previously telling Congress he was not aware of any Trump campaign official talking to Russian officials. Sessions' remark contradicts the statements of two former Trump campaign aides, Carter Page and George Papadopoulos, who've admitted they had contacts with Russians during the campaign. Meanwhile, Sessions has asked officials to look into whether a special prosecutor is needed to investigate the Clinton Foundation and an Obama-era deal to sell a uranium company to Russia. In news from Syria, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is reporting at least 53 people have been killed in airstrikes outside of Aleppo. The dead include at least 5 children and 3 women. Meanwhile, the BBC is reporting hundreds of fighters with the Islamic State were allowed to leave Raqqa last month as part of a secret deal with the U.S.-led coalition to end the fighting in Raqqa. A BBC investigation found about 250 militants left in October, along with 3,500 members of their families and their weapons. Some of the fighters headed to other parts of Syria controlled by the so-called Islamic State. Others went to Turkey. In Wisconsin, a 14-year-old Native American teenager was shot dead last week by a deputy in the Ashland County Sheriff's Department. Jason Pirro was a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Tribe of Chippewa Indians. The shooting occurred after police received a 911 call about a man walking down the street with a knife. Investigators now believe the 14-year-old was the one who'd made the 911 call. Pirro's grandfather criticized the police for using lethal force. Alan Pirro said, quote, he got murdered out in front of the house here. He's a boy. There's warning shots. There's tasers. There's pepper spray. You don't go right on a 14-year-old kid and go for the kill zone, his grandfather said. Football player Colin Kaepernick has been named Citizen of the Year by GQ for sparking a movement against racism after he refused to stand last year for the national anthem before an NFL game. The magazine wrote, quote, he's been vilified by millions and locked out of the NFL all because he took a knee to protest police brutality. Kaepernick's determined stand puts him in rare company in sports history. Muhammad Ali, Jackie Robinson, athletes who risked everything to make a difference, GQ said. And the professor and media critic Edward Herman has died at the age of 92. He was author of many books, including Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, which he co-authored with Noam Chomsky. This is a clip of Ed Herman appearing in the film The Brainwashing of My Dad.
The mainstream media are elite institutions. The ownership of the media is concentrated in the hands of very wealthy individuals. The media system is really a powerful set of structures. Most people don't have a choice. They don't have a spectrum of available choices that they can look at and say, oh, I like this or that. So you have a very limited, constrained set of options to begin with. So that's a bias that's built into the structure of the system.
Ed Herman died on Saturday at the age of 92. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, we're broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit here in Bonn, Germany, the home of Beethoven. This is the first climate summit since President Trump has vowed to pull the United States out of the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, a process that takes 4 years. While this action would leave the United States entirely isolated as the only nation on Earth that's not a party to the agreement, many other nations' leaders are worried about the Trump effect, the idea that the U.S.'s planned withdrawal will allow other nations to also weaken their commitments to the Paris deal. New data by the Global Carbon Project shows global carbon dioxide emissions are once again rising after flatlining for 3 straight years. These findings dash earlier hopes that global CO2 emissions had peaked for good. Well, at this year's climate change conference, African negotiators, activists, and youth are particularly vocal about the need for urgent action to mitigate the most devastating effects of climate change. The continent is expected to suffer more from climate change than any other on Earth. Many African countries are already feeling some of the worst effects. This summer, flooding and mudslides in Sierra Leone killed more than 1,000 people, while extreme drought has left millions of people at risk of famine in Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia. To talk more about this year's negotiations and environmental movements across Africa, we're joined by Kumi Naidu, longtime South African anti-apartheid activist, former head of Greenpeace International. He's now the head of a new organization called Africans Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity. Kumi, it's great to have you back on Democracy Now! So we've had you on as head of Greenpeace International. Now you're starting a new organization. Talk about what is happening in Africa and why you see the need for this group?
Well, firstly, people need to understand that climate impacts are already devastating the African continent. The difference with us compared to, say, hurricanes that happen or typhoons that happen in Southeast Asia, the main impacts of climate at the moment is climate-intensified drought and climate-intensified desertification. And these are not cataclysmic media moments like a typhoon or a hurricane is. But people need to understand that the terrible injustice of this is that the people that are paying the price, the first most brutal price with their lives, with their livelihoods, with their soil, with their water and so on, are those that lead the most low consumptive lifestyles anywhere in the planet. And the lack of action that we have seen from the dominant parts of the world suggests to us that, in fact, what we are dealing with is a problem that you could call climate apartheid. That, in fact, if you look at where the problem has been caused mostly and where the impacts are, that it is people of color, whether it's in the Pacific, whether it's in Africa, whether it's in the Middle East and so on, are in the front edge. I guarantee you that if it was flipped, we would probably have much more action, because the reality is that as Africans, we recognize that racism is alive and well at the global level, and we see it in places like the United States in a very powerful way now. And part of getting a climate solution is about actually valuing human life in an equal way across the planet.
Can you talk about the Trump effect, and if there is one? This is the first climate summit where the president of the United States has said he's pulling the United States out of the accord, leaving the U.S. alone in the world as the only country not part of the Paris Climate Accord. What effect do you see that having?
I think it's had a negative and a positive effect. The negative effect is that it's left the majority of Americans today feeling their president is not acting in their interests, is giving up global leadership, and so on. The fact that he is gone after the Paris Climate Accord, we must remind ourselves, and people seem to have forgotten about this at this negotiations, that Paris was not a perfect accord. It simply gave us the chance to live to fight another day, right? It got the negotiations back on track. We need to go beyond the Paris commitments, and we built into the Paris Accord review mechanisms and to increase, ambition and so on. When I tongue-in-cheek say he's also been positive, is that because Donald Trump is reviled by the majority of Americans, is totally reviled by people across the world, it's actually got people who never really took interest in passion in climate saying, well, you know, if Donald Trump is against this accord, there must be something good in it. And if you look at the United States, you can see how governors, local government leaders and so on are stepping up to say, we will meet those commitments without, necessarily the support of the federal government.
You know, we have something unusual happening right now, Kumi, right behind you. You can just turn around. David Banks, the U.S. representative for President Trump, his energy advisor, is standing right there. Our producer, Nicole Salazar, is asking if he would come over and join this discussion. He's the one who had the only U.S. summit. Would you come on over, David, to join this discussion? David, if you just come for 5 minutes to join us to talk. Okay. Very good. He's saying that he's tempted. Come on over. Okay, we're trying to get him to come over.
This is the first time I've had this interview, and it's great. And let's just say that those of us who believe that the Paris Accord must be met and exceeded, we are completely willing to dialogue and educate President Trump and the people around him, because it's clear they are in need of a desperate injection of reality. They have created a little bubble for themselves, and they are living in this bubble. It's clear. I mean, you know, even Syria has signed the accord, you know.
And Nicaragua before, which hadn't signed because they thought it was too weak.
Too weak, yes.
So, but they've signed.
And they've signed it not because they think the Paris Accord is great, but they believe that the global community has to work together to address this problem. And Donald Trump and the people of America need to understand that what he is doing, he is actually undermining American economic interests apart from anything else. If you look at meetings I had when I was at Greenpeace with Chinese leaders, it comes out very clear that they have come to a conclusion that the successful countries of the future are not those that dominate the arms race or the space race. The successful economies of the future are going to be those that dominate the green race, those that get as far ahead of the green technology race now. That is why you find China, for example, 90% of solar panels installed in Europe comes from China. And China is I would prefer that panels be installed in China, but that's a different story. But they have turned the crisis of climate change into an economic competitive advantage. And so long as Donald Trump and the small number of people around him that are pushing him in a particular direction stick to the position, they are not only undermining the possibility of life on the planet, they're also undermining the short, medium, and long-term economic interests of the United States.
I mean, interestingly, you know, President Trump is a proud climate change denier. He has called it a Chinese hoax. But in fact, sadly, climate change is a Chinese bonanza because the U.S. isn't supporting alternative energies. I believe the environmental advisor for President Trump, Kathleen Hartnett White, who just had her confirmation hearings before the Senate, we'll see if she's actually confirmed, has said that, you know, agrees with President Trump. And says carbon dioxide is a plant nutrient and that solar power is parasitic.
Wow. So, you know, what you see happening in the Trump administration is a really very bad dose of cognitive dissonance, where the science is crystal clear. And if you didn't want to deal with the complexity of the science, all you have to look at what has happened in the last decade. In the last decade, we've had more than 100% increase in extreme weather events. You know, people will say, yes, there always was hurricanes. True, there was always hurricanes, typhoons, and so on. But what you find now, without any reasonable doubt, the frequency of such events is increasing. The strength of and the impact and the devastation caused is breaking record after record. And we need to understand that this is not about saving the planet. People need to understand that the struggle that we engage in here is to ensure that our children and their children's futures are protected. And Donald Trump is betraying not only the American future generation, but people around the world.
Kumi, we're going to break. Then we're going to go to what happened yesterday at the only U.S. session here. And I want to say over your right shoulder again, David Banks remains there, though he hasn't walked over a few feet to sit down next to you to have a debate. Yesterday in the panel, he said he was fully accessible. We'll see what happens if we can get him this week. Again, he is Donald Trump's special assistant to the president, International Energy and Environment. But we're going to play that session and the walkout that took place, the actual revolt leaving the room three quarters empty, when David Banks and other and the White House, the vice president, Pence's representative, talked about supporting Donald Trump and pulling out of the climate accord, but also their corporate executives, the only panel here of the U.S. government were representatives of nuclear, gas, and coal. And that's what you're going to hear next. And then we'll get Kumi Naidoo's response. And if we're lucky, David Banks, the president's representative, will join us as well. Stay with us.
We, the people, are ready to lead. We, the people, are ready to lead. 'Cause the White House making it hard to breathe. The White House making it hard to breathe. All the oil men full of greed. All the oil men full of greed. Better leave the UN at great, great speed. And you can never take away the people of the world standing here today. And you can never take away the people of the world standing here today. Are ready to lead. We, the people, are ready to lead. 'Cause the White House making it hard to breathe. The White House making it hard to breathe. All the oil men, they're full of greed. All the oil men are full of greed. Better leave the UN at great, great speed. You can never take away the people of the world standing here today. You can never take away the people of the world.
One more time. Here we go.
We, the people, are ready to lead. We, the people, are ready to lead. 'Cause the White House making it hard to breathe. The White House making it hard to breathe. All the oil men, they're full of greed. All the oil men are full of greed. Better leave the UN at great, great speed. Better leave the UN at great, great speed. 'Cause you can never take away the people.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit here in Bonn, Germany. Yesterday, people revolted. We're urging you to go to the phone right now. Here in Bonn, Germany, close to 200 countries are gathered. The U.S. says that it is pulling out of the climate accord. Well, on Monday night, activists and Democratic lawmakers staged a full-fledged revolt as the Trump administration made its official debut at this year's COP at a forum pushing coal, gas, and nuclear power. The presentation was entitled The Role of Cleaner and More Efficient Fossil Fuels and Nuclear Power in Climate Mitigation. It included speakers from the coal company Peabody Energy, the nuclear engineering firm NuScale Power, and a gas exporter. The panel was the only official appearance by the U.S. delegation during this year's U.N. Climate Summit. Well, Democracy Now! Was there Monday night as the U.S. delegation made its official debut. It didn't go too well. At least it didn't begin well, with the White House consultant telling Democracy Now! We could not film him.
Hi. I don't know what you're doing, but please don't take any photos of me.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Governor Kate Brown from Oregon and Governor J&J from Washington.
This is a sideshow. It is a blip. The world is not paying any attention to it because the world is not going to listen to someone who says that climate change is a hoax. You can report this news from Bonn. While Donald Trump is trying to sell old technology to an unforgiving world and an unforgiving science, the third largest economy in the world is moving forward with clean energy jobs, and that's the United States Climate Alliance, and I'm proud to be leading it. Kate Brown of Oregon.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Governor Inslee. We're delighted to be here. It is absolutely clear that President Trump is rejecting the economy of the future. Three states working together, California, Washington, and Oregon. With British Columbia, we represent one-fifth of the world's economy. That's an extraordinary resource. We're all pulling together. We're rowing in the same direction, and we're going to move this economy forward. And we're doing it by investing in renewable energy and energy conservation.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Good luck. Feel good.
Thank you.
Feel good.
Thank you.
We're about to see the only U.S. Embassy press conference or public event here at the COP, and it is filled with corporate executives from the nuclear industry, from coal, Peabody Coal to be exact, and natural gas. The room is packed because, well, it's the only event that they've held in this two-week COP so far.
With that, I'd like to introduce to you Dave Banks, who is President Trump's Special Assistant for International Energy and Environment.
The United States is blessed with an abundance of all types of energy. The President wants to use our country's vast resources to create jobs at home and create a competitive advantage that helps revitalize U.S. manufacturing. The President also wants to use our energy resources to benefit our allies and partners, to provide them greater energy security and prosperity.
The chart.
American, but we see right through your greed. It's killing all across the world for that coal money, and we proudly stand up until you keep it in the ground. Let the people of the world unite, and we are here to stay.
My name is Isabella Zizi. I come from Richmond, California. I'm 23 years old. I'm part of the Indigenous Environmental Network delegation here, but I'm also a member of the Idle No More SF Bay in San Francisco Bay Area in California. And today there was a huge walkout rally from the U.S. press conference that was happening in the room right behind us, who they were really promoting this so-called clean energy of using coal, nuclear plants, and also liquefied natural gas. And so that was their way of saying, you know, like, yeah, you know, this is good energy, but we from the United States were saying, no, this is a false solution.
My name is Tanu Yakupitiege. I'm with 350.org, and I'm the coordinator of the U.S. People's Delegation, which includes a lot of the groups that were here on stage speaking after the White House panel. I was inside, and it was just a really beautiful collective moment of resistance where over close to 100 people who entered the White House panel, we listened to basically a crony for President Trump speak about clean coal and clean nuclear and give his reasoning for why this is super important, even though nobody else at the COP is saying it. And then we collectively rose up together in unison singing a song of resistance, and we turned and faced the press, and we held the space for over 10 minutes, and then we marched out to link with the front lines communities, who, including It Takes Roots Coalition, who's also part of the People's Delegation, who are holding the space here, and together we really put forward the voices of those most impacted by the climate crisis, and we really wanted to hold a space in contrast to this panel that was really propping fossil fuel billionaires and telling the lies of the Trump administration, and really contrast that with the truth from our communities.
Hi, my name is Varshini Prakash. I am from Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm here with the Sustain Us Youth Delegation and also Sunrise Movement. And I am here because, as a young person, I am scared about the threat of climate change right now and in the future. And I am angry that people like Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson are putting my life and the lives of billions of others at risk. So we just sang inside a fossil fuel panel, basically, presentation, and about 100 of us stood up together and sang our own version of God Bless America, to really reclaim this identity that America should be about liberty and justice for all, that it should be about an actual American dream, not just a dream for the fossil fuel billionaires and the elite 1% in our country. So we sang this song and we walked out, all of us, and left them talking to each other and almost nobody in the room itself, and came out and joined hundreds of other people who weren't able to make it into the panel room itself.
Hey, my name is Jesus Vasquez. I'm from Puerto Rico. It's day number 56 since Hurricane Maria devastated our islands. And for us, it is very important to get our message out that we know climate change is real. We know the Caribbean waters and the Atlantic Ocean are warmer. We know we experimented two big hurricanes in a short amount of time. You know, we have Hurricane Irma, then 2 weeks after we got Hurricane Maria. For us, it is very disrespectful to know that this is going to continue, knowing just that 56 days ago, we got hit hard by a hurricane, and we're still in a country that is militarized by the U.S., U.S. military presence. We have limited access to clean water, and we have almost no power, no electricity. So we know this thing is real, and to know that fossil fuels are going to be continuing, and also nuclear energy, it's just guaranteeing that next year we're going to be in the same situation, and the risk is going to continue.
Our final speaker today is Lenka Koller. She's the Director of Business Strategy at New Scale Power.
I really appreciate the young people that were in here earlier voicing their opinion. I think it's important to do that, and I only wish they had stayed in the room. As Amos said earlier, we need to listen to each other. We don't do that enough, even if we disagree with each other. Last week, I spoke at a Women in Clean Tech and Sustainability event at Google, and I talked about the tribalism that we often see in this field and how we pit ourselves against each other, and that doesn't really get us to the goals that we mutually want to reach. Nuclear energy needs to be a part of the conversation here at the Climate Talks in Bonn and at future climate talks and all of the forums that we host throughout the year in which we're talking about large energy transitions.
I'm going to introduce Holly Krutka, the Vice President of Coal Generation and Emissions Technologies at Peabody Energy.
Let me begin by saying that while some people clearly believe that there's no common ground here and that there's no path forward for fossil fuels in a carbon-constrained world, we don't believe that's the case. There are technologies available today and others in the technology development pipeline that can dramatically reduce emissions from coal and other fossil fuels. And more to the point, these technologies are vital to achieving the goals of the Paris Agreement.
Right, I'm Amy Goodman from the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
This is our last question before we have to wrap up.
Quick question, just a simple yes or no from each of you, whether you support President Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. If we could begin with Lenka.
I'm here for a reason, and that's to support climate change mitigation.
Just a quick, simple yes or no answer.
Well, the question was
whether you support President Trump pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord.
No, I don't support it.
Holly?
I know you want yes or no, but our company's statement wasn't yes or no. So please just allow me to say what it is. We did not ever weigh in. There was reports actually that we weighed in both directions. Our opinion was that it's up to them. There's a lot to decide, but whether or not the U.S. is in the Paris Climate Agreement, we will continue to work on low emissions technologies for coal.
And you personally, Holly?
Gosh, I'm not really a policy person. I'm sorry, that was a cop-out. You're right. I personally, I'm not here to represent myself, so come talk to me afterwards.
No, are you for or against?
I'm not going to answer for my personal opinion.
Amos?
I think I have the easiest task. I don't think Dave or Francis expect me to say anything else. I work for the Obama administration. I supported the Paris agreements, fully thought it was a great achievement for the president.
Barry Worthington, yes or no?
There's actually two answers. The U.S. Energy Association did not take a position before the president pulled out of Paris. As soon as he pulled out of Paris, we issued a statement saying that he should renegotiate Paris. From my own personal standpoint, the answer is yes because of the reasons I laid out. We're achieving the emissions reductions goals without having the regulatory burden. We're doing it for other reasons.
Francis Brooke.
Thanks, Barry. And now we're going to go to closing.
No, Francis,
from our
I'd
speakers.
Like your response.
Can you? We're not
just
here.
Just two more people. Simple question, just yes or no.
I mean, pretty clearly, we both work for the administration, so that's who we're here to represent, and it's not going to change anything. So we're going to go
and
through
David
closing
Banks,
now.
Your final question.
So we're going to start with Barry
yes or
Worthington.
No.
He's going to close for us.
David, any answer? I work for the President of the United States.
So is it a yes or a no?
And that was David Banks, White House Special Assistant for International Energy and Environment, the person we've been trying to get on the show who's been standing next to our broadcast. Before that, Francis Brooke, policy aide in the office of Vice President Mike Pence, of the four corporate representatives pushing nuclear, gas and coal, two of them said they were, well, Lenka Kohler of New Scale Energy and Amos Hochstein of Telluride disagreed with Trump pulling the U.S. out of this climate agreement. Holly Krutka of Peabody Wouldn't Say and Barry Worthington of the U.S. Energy Association agreed with President Trump's withdrawal. That was the final question at the Trump administration's one and only panel here at the COP23. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We are broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany. This year, it's known as the first Islands COP, with Fiji presiding over this year's summit. The event itself is being held in Bonn, Germany, because of the logistical challenges of hosting 25,000 people in Fiji at the start of the South Pacific cyclone season. Today is also Gender Day here at the UN Climate Conference. Well, we're joined now by the first woman president of the Marshall Islands, Hilda Heine, and her daughter, poet and climate change activist, Kathy Jetnell Kijener. This is Kathy reading one of her poems at a UN climate change gathering in New York City in 2014, only days after the massive People's Climate March, the largest climate march in history. Kathy's poem is written as a letter to her child.
Dear Mata Felipinum, don't cry. Mommy promises you no one will come and devour you. No greedy whale of a company sharking through political seas. No backwater bullying of businesses with broken morals. No blindfolded bureaucracies gonna push this mother ocean over the edge. No one's drowning, baby. No one's moving. No one's losing their homeland. No one's becoming a climate change refugee. Or should I say, no one else. To the Carteret Islanders of Papua New Guinea and to the Taro Islanders of Fiji, I take this moment to apologize to you. We are drawing the line here because we, baby, are going to fight. Your mommy, daddy, boo-boo, jima, your country, and your president, too. We will all
That's
fight.
That's Kathy Jetnell Kijener back in 2014. Well, less than 2 years later, her own mother, Hilda Heine, was elected president of the Marshall Islands, becoming the first female president of an independent Pacific nation. And they're still fighting. Climate change and sea level rise poses a particularly devastating threat to low-lying island nations like the Marshall Islands, a chain of volcanic islands and coral atolls in the middle of the Pacific Ocean between Hawaii and the Philippines. According to a report by the U.S. Geological Survey, many atoll islands will be flooded annually, salinizing the limited freshwater resources and thus likely forcing inhabitants to abandon their islands in decades, not centuries, as previously thought, unquote. But climate change is not the first existential threat the Marshall Islands has faced. Between 1946 and 58, the United States conducted more than 60 large-scale nuclear tests there. The largest, known as the Bravo shot, was 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb and vaporized three small islands. The nuclear testing forced people from their homes and caused long-lasting health impacts, including women giving birth to jellyfish babies. Tiny infants born with no bones. In 2014, the Marshall Islands launched an unprecedented lawsuit against the United States and eight other countries at the International Court of Justice at The Hague, accusing them of failing to meet international commitments for nuclear disarmament. The lawsuit was rejected in 2016 after the court said it did not have jurisdiction over the case. Well, for more on climate change and the long legacy of nuclear testing, we're joined now by the president of the Marshall Islands herself, Hilda Heine, and her poet daughter, climate change activist Kathy Jetnell Kitchener. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Madam President, your thoughts today at this first Islands COP, this first COP summit, the UN Climate Summit, that is sponsored by another South Pacific island, Fiji. The significance of this?
Well, it's very significant for Pacific Island countries, you know, being our first one. So it's important for us to be here to let the world know that everyone has to do their part. We're wanting to be here to make sure that countries increase their ambition so that the 1.5 degrees can be maintained. That's the importance for our island country in order for us to survive. So it's very important. This COP is very important for us.
And this is the first UN climate summit since President Trump announced that he's pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. What does that mean to you?
That's why it's all that more important for us to be here and to gather the support from other countries around the world. We were very disappointed when President Trump pulled out the United States from the Paris Agreement. We see them as important leaders in the world and should be taking the leadership role in the climate fight. So when he decided to pull the U.S. from the Paris Agreement, it was a very disappointing act for countries like the Marshall Islands.
What message do you have for President Trump today? We just played their first, and it looks like only, event that they're holding here at the climate summit, where they were pushing coal, nuclear, and gas.
Well, I think we're all for coal to be kept underground, and we want to make sure that President Trump understand the importance of emission and what's going on in terms of coal being promoted by his administration. We want to make sure that, or we want President Trump to acknowledge the science. There's no longer debate about the issue of climate change. We need to make sure that, you know, we're doing all we can to ensure the survivability of all the island countries, especially, and the rest of the world.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you about this idea, which sadly isn't an idea but a reality, of what they call jellyfish babies. Can you talk about the legacy of nuclear testing in the South Pacific, in the Marshall Islands? Talk about, first of all, how many islands make up the Marshall Islands? I don't think people realize the breadth and scope.
Yeah, well, we have 33 islands in the Marshall Islands, atolls, actually, with many other smaller islands, about 1,000 some. But the communities are 33. We have 24 island that are inhabited with actual communities in the Marshall Islands. The legacy of the the nuclear testing program brings back the old issue of colonialism and how the U.S. has colonized the Marshall Islands. To this day, we're still struggling with the legacy of the, what you call jellyfish babies. We have people.
This is babies without bones.
Babies without bones that were born by women who lived in the islands that were contaminated. And we still have people who have not returned to their homelands after 50 years of being displaced from their homelands. We have islands that were vaporized by the nuclear testing program. Of course, these islands belong to people, and those can never be recovered. So we're still seeking nuclear justice for the people of the Marshall Islands. Mm-hmm. This is one of the legacy of the U.S. Presence in our country. And it seems like we're repeating with the climate change issue coming on, also same force from outside being brought to influence or to impact the livelihood of Marshallese. Mm.
Your grandniece, Kathy, your niece, Kathy Kitchener, died at the age of 8 of leukemia?
Oh, talking about Bianca.
Bianca. Yeah, she died at 8 as a result of leukemia.
Yeah.
And many children like that also. It's not a, this is one of the common, what do you call
sicknesses?
Sickness.
You have some of the highest rates of cancers in the world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You suffer the highest rates of cancer in the world.
Yeah, with some of the highest.
Yeah, so this is one of the impact, the health impact on the people of the Marshall Islands is beyond our budget to ensure that the people have are healthy. Again, legacy of the nuclear testing
now the Hague,
program.
The Hague, the International Court of Justice, said it's not within its jurisdiction to rule on this suit that you have against the Marshall Islands, and they threw the case out. Are you still asking the United States for reparations? And what does it mean to you that at this COP, COP23, at this summit, the U.S. is pushing nuclear power?
Well, it's the same thing as pushing the use of coal, in a world that is acknowledged that climate change is here. And yet, on the face of that, U.S. is here pushing for use of clean coal, if there is such a thing. And it's the same thing with the nuclear justice. Here we are. We're still struggling with that, and we don't see the end of this journey for those people who were impacted by the nuclear testing program of the United States. Mm-hmm. So we continue to seek justice. We go to the we'll be going to the United Nations, and we're trying to also get advocates from around the country to help us with the nuclear justice. Mm-hmm. That is required.
So on this gender day, we're here with a mother-daughter team. Madam President, you are the first woman president, not only of the Marshall Islands, but of the Pacific Islands. And Kathy Jetno-Kitchener, you are her daughter and a longtime climate activist yourself, poet. You wrote a letter to your daughter. We just played a clip of it before, a poem to your daughter. What does it mean to you that your mother has been elected president, and what does it mean for the Marshall Islands?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really expect it to happen at all. I mean, I never thought that I would see my mom as, as a leader of a country and as a leader of our country, not because she's not, perfect for it, not because she's not worthy, but just because, so much of our society is extremely patriarchal, and I think that's also a result of colonization. And I think, seeing her become president tells me that there are actually changes being made and that there is actually hope for a lot of us women to continue to push and continue to take on leadership positions and make changes that we want to see in the world. And I think that's really, it gave me a lot of hope. And I was extremely proud, of course. Yeah.
Your final comment, I know you're heading off to yet another meeting. This is part of being president. Your final comment to women of the world, why you see in particular the effects of women and children, the effects of climate change, what you see are those effects?
Well, there is in the Marshall Islands, we see the effects on women and their life because they are the caretakers of the home. So if there is drought, they're the ones that will have to go out and look for water for the family, look for food in order to cook the meals for the family. So their life is really upside down when there is these events from climate change. We see that firsthand with our droughts, with inundation of the waves coming over our islands and washing homes away. It's the women leading the solutions, looking for solutions for families, like they always do. Climate change is another addition to the work that women continue to do to make their families survive.
We're going to end with the comments of a previous Marshall Islands political leader. I want to thank you so much for being with us. We're going to turn to longtime Marshall Islands political leader, anti-nuclear activist Tony DeBroom, the late leader. DeBroom was one of the world's most prominent voices confronting climate change, spent decades organizing against nuclear weapons after having witnessed firsthand the U.S. nuclear testing and his homeland. This is DeBroom speaking in 2015 as he accepted the Right Livelihood Award, known as the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize.
Decades after the conclusion of devastating nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands, I might be branded by some as a radical for my impassioned conviction against the use, testing, or possession of nuclear weapons. But this is not radical. It is only logical. I have seen with my very own eyes such devastation and know with conviction that nuclear weapons must never again be visited upon humanity. Between 1946 and 1958, the United States conducted 67 large-scale nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands. That is the equivalence of 1.6 Hiroshima shots every day for 12 years.
That was Tony DeBroom, longtime Marshall Islands political leader, accepting the Right Livelihood Award a few years ago, the late leader. And I wanted to end with Kathy Jetnell-Kitchener, talking about your NoDAPL solidarity. That's the Dakota Access Pipeline.
I was really inspired by the work of the indigenous protesters in NoDAPL, just because they were fighting for their land and for clean water in the same way that we are fighting for our islands in the Marshall Islands. And as someone who lives in the U.S. at the moment, I wanted to show my support for the people of their land. And that's why I wrote that poem for them last year. But for me, really, I think I am really inspired by the work of a lot of indigenous activists around the world who are trying to fight for their home, for their culture, and for their people.
Thanks so much. Again, our guests have been Kathy Jetnell-Kitchener, poet and climate activist, and the first woman president of the Marshall Islands, President Hilda Heine. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Kumi Naidoo joins us to respond to the U.S. one and only session here at the COP summit, where they brought in corporate executives from the nuclear, gas and coal industry to represent the president of the United States. Stay with us.
É por isso que esse nosso amor é assim tão grande, que mesmo na distância nunca te esquecer. Mãe carinhosa, mãe carinhosa, mãe, mãe carinhosa. Ó terra mãe, a emoção é do filho pródigo, que já volta cheio de ansiedade para a borca lenta. Ó terra mãe, a emoção é do filho pródigo, que já volta cheio de ansiedade para a boa ternura. Mãe carinhosa, boi mãe carinhosa, mãe carinhosa, boi mãe carinhosa. Thank you.
pesar de sol cascol, des vent constant, des xomaguat. Voy mai carinyosa, mai carinyosa. Voy mai carinyosa.
Loving Mother by Cesaria Vora of Cape Verde Islands off of Africa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit here in Bonn, Germany. We just played for you the protests that took place, the revolt that took place yesterday at the U.S.'s only session that they held here. This first COP after President Trump announced plans to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. But it's a four-year process, and if that goes through, it ends the day after the next election day. The official debut of the U.S. administration was at a forum pushing coal, gas and nuclear power. The presentation, including speakers from Peabody Energy, NuScale Nuclear and a gas exporter. We are continuing our conversation now with Kumi Naidu, South African activist, former head of Greenpeace, now chairperson of Africans Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity. Now, we have pleaded with David Banks, the U.S. president's representative, President Trump's representative here, who said he was completely accessible, stayed right next to our booth throughout the time all of our producers went out to talk to him, but said he would not come on the broadcast, at least today. We'll attempt to try. But Kumi Naidu, as you went off the set for a few minutes, you got a chance to speak with David Banks.
I spent about 15 minutes with him. He seems to be a decent human being. He basically is not denying any of the things that we are saying. But his argument is, oh, technology and innovation will sort everything out. And
but not solar and wind.
Yeah, I know it's really focused on a hold. And I put it to him that, do you realize that you are actually giving up economic opportunities because of successful economies? Body language suggests that they are aware of that. And the fact that isolation, and they say they, President Trump has not ruled out the possibility of coming back. But right now, let me tell you, and Amy, you and I have been at COPs for so long. Right now, almost now, people want to say, actually, if the U.S. is going to behave like this, better they stay out. Let the rest of the world go ahead. And we work with the governors of those states that want to be involved, the majority of municipalities in the United States that want to be involved, the civil society.
And, We're Still In coalition.
Yeah,
yesterday,
yeah.
Governor Inslee and Governor Kate Brown of Oregon and Washington State almost took over the U.S. government's press event by just coming in and stating basically this is a sham.
And I want to say something to the UNFCCC. The people that did that peaceful protest, they've been debadged and thrown out.
They have been.
That's what I understand. I stand to be corrected. I did a protest that what happened to me as well some years ago. But what they did with that panel, this only first panel, is an impeachable offense, really. I mean, it may. They come and present something.
You mean the U.S. government,
the Trump
administration.
To do a panel that actually goes against 99.99% of the scientific consensus in the world, right? And to give them a platform to do that, I say to the UNFCCC that, in fact, it is inappropriate and the UN cannot continue to pander to the madness that comes out of the Trump administration. We have to say to them, if you want to be out, you stay out. Don't come and poison this negotiations the way that you're doing. If those that are aligned to the vision of the Paris Accord, limit, you know, imperfect as it is, let us move ahead. Because what they do here is they come, they suck up a lot of oxygen, they hold back negotiations, and let's be blunt about it. It's not as if the Obama administration was perfect here. They also held us back. It's just that, you know, or certainly the Trump administration.
We have 10 seconds for your final
also
message.
Did it. So time is running out. We need American people. And we are happy that at least the American people are with us, if not the American presidency.
We thank you so much, Kumi Naidoo, South African activist, former head of Greenpeace, now chairperson of Africans Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity. And that does it for our broadcast here in Bonn, Germany. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Brick, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Nicole Salazar, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Amel Ahmed, Nat Needham, Dennis Moynihan. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from COP23 in Bonn, Germany. Thanks for joining us.